Turn to Matthew chapter 17. Matthew 17. We have some visitors here. This is really hard to series to just come into right in the middle. I say in the middle, we're at the end. Where I'm at today, this has been building for how many weeks we've been doing this? Are we going on 2 months? Probably, it's probably been 8 weeks, nearly 8 hours worth. So we're probably rolling into the eighth or ninth hour of just this teaching. It's just had to be cut off at some point on Sunday. Then we pick back up. I do want to, today's going to be real teachy. Some of you, I'll say again, some of you may not like this. Some of you may not like it at all. Some of you may completely disagree as far as your theology, not really theology, but I guess, you'll see. If you disagree, you'll know. You'll know you do if you do. But I'm going to present to you what I believe. But again, the things I say today, you don't have to believe like me in this to still arrive at what I think God is showing us. And I'll explain that to you again. This all started with 2 Corinthians chapter 3. And I say this every week, but we can't forget where we come from. 2 Corinthians chapter 3, Paul's writing to the church. And he makes this beautiful, beautiful statement, blows my mind. To me, this should be the core of the church. You don't hear as much about it, but he says that in the Spirit there is freedom to behold the glory of God. Amen. But it personifies the glory of God. It is a person. It is Jesus. Somebody say Jesus. Behold his glory. Paul says this to the church, that as you are looking at him, you begin to be transformed into the image of that glory. How does a man become like Jesus? Okay, you get born again and you get this divine nature inside of you. You were dead in your trespasses and sins. You get saved. I like the word born again. You don't hear it explained that way as much anymore, but I love it. Salvation is you are forgiven, you get saved, you're pardoned, you enter into a covenant with God, but also you're a new creation. He takes where you were dead in your trespasses and sins. You are born again, this new birth, this spirit man, this dead on the inside comes alive, saved by grace through faith. You were dead in your trespasses and sins, but he makes you alive. This is what Paul teaches in Ephesians chapter 2. It's beautiful. He says that he writes the law on your heart. One prophet says in the Old Testament. Other prophet says he takes out a heart of stone and puts you a living heart inside. So from the Old Testament to the New, Jesus don't just pardon you. This is not just judicial. This is not just legally made right. Salvation is more than legally made right with God. It is your creative being is made right with God. You're born again. But from that point on, we walk in a relationship with Jesus, which is not just going to church, checking boxes, and tithing, and hear a sermon, and trying not to cuss a lot or drink a lot or to be mean to people. I mean, that we've narrowed down the culture I grew up in was that. If you can just not do five or six things and then go to church on Sundays, you're good. Call yourself a Christian. But it is so much more. You walk with this Jesus, and through the Holy Spirit, we get to get glimpses of his glory. And when we fix our eyes on his glory, it changes us into something that makes us less like the person I've always been. Every time I behold the glory of Jesus, I get a little bit less like Stetton. And that's good. That's good. Because, listen, Stetton's caused Stetton trouble a lot more than anybody in the room has. I can blame it on anybody. I can blame it on my enemy. But really, if I get down to it, Stetton's caused Stetton the most trouble. And I love it that he's delivering me from me, too, by making me more like him. And I love it that he gives you a glory, and I behold it, and it changes me. And he says, oh, you got that? Let me show you this now. He shows me another glory, something, another facet, another depth of himself. He says, look at this now. And I see that glory, and it does something to me. Paul teaches this. We are in the season of beholding the glory. If you ain't figured it out by now, we're in the season of beholding his glory. When Paul teaches this, he uses, in 2 Corinthians 3, he goes back and looks at the old covenant versus the new covenant, the law that's in the old covenant versus this the spirit and the grace that's in the new covenant, and he looks at the person of Moses versus Jesus. So this is what we've did for 8 weeks. We've went back into the old covenant. We actually went all the way back to Adam before there was a covenant, and we looked at how we arrived at the covenant. We walked through the covenant, saw what the covenant's about, the law. I challenge you to go back and listen to this, because there's perspective that you don't hear in the just average language about the law. Go back and check this out. It's gorgeous. So you look at that as we go through the law, and we see how the old covenant gets fulfilled. We make our way through from Mount Sinai to Matthew. The reason why is in the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, you find this chiastic structure when it is written by the Holy Spirit, in which you have Mount Sinai in the middle, and many things that happen leading up to Sinai also happens after Sinai. I give you the example every time that Moses gets tired when they leave Egypt going to Sinai, and then he delegates some of his responsibility. Moses will go through this again as they're making their way to the Promised Land. He'll get tired and delegate some responsibility. You're going to see they fight a certain group of people before, afterwards. I think there's seven references to wilderness before, seven afterwards. God does a miracle feeding in the wilderness on the way to Sinai. He'll do it again after Sinai. There's a lot of things that happen, and what you find is right in the middle, this chiastic structure. There's something happening there, and Paul pulls from that and brings you over to Jesus Christ, and by the time we see it in our Gospels, we go to Matthew, and we find the same chiastic structures in the book of Matthew, and it is the mountain motif. Right in the middle of Matthew, we have this mountain, the Mount of Transfiguration. Remember, Moses sees God's glory, and he sees Moses' face shines, and now you see Jesus on the mountain reveals himself as God, and his face shines. I believe Moses was looking at Jesus on Sinai. Amen? But he's showing you this. He's showing you this mountain motif. We've been walking through it. If you'll remember, let me see where to start right here. If you'll remember, what you find in Matthew, I've erased a lot of my mountain pictures. What you find in Matthew, and hang with me. So when we're in Matthew and we see Jesus, I don't even know why. Okay, you see Jesus in Matthew. So one thing that he clearly does, if you'll remember, Jesus is born. They want to kill him, right, when he's a baby. Kill all the boys. Flees to Egypt, safety. Moses, the same. When he was a little boy, they was going to kill all the boys. So you see that the parallelism there. Then you see from that, Moses, with the children of Israel, they come out of Egypt. They go through the Red Sea. Jesus goes through the Jordan, into the Jordan. Children of Israel, Moses, go into the wilderness. Jesus goes into the wilderness. Israel fails temptation in the wilderness on the way to Sinai. Jesus is tempted in the wilderness on the way to the Mount of Transfiguration. Israel is tempted in the same ways that Jesus is. Jesus responds with the very scriptures that God spoke to Israel in their wilderness temptation. Do you see that? Now, I spent hours walking that out. In Matthew, Jesus lives Israel's old covenant. He lives out their journey. He walks out their journey, Israel's journey. And every failure they made in the old covenant, Jesus walks it out and keeps it. This is why Jesus said, I didn't come to do away with the old covenant. I didn't come to do away with the law. I come to fulfill the law. Now, if you go back even, I suggested to you that the two stone tablets, because Jeremiah says that on Mount Sinai, that's where I give you the tablets and the covenant started. And God says in Jeremiah, he said, and don't you know that Israel's my wife? Now, what I said, There's this twofold relationship that happens with Israel. On one hand, God calls Israel his wife. Sometimes he calls Israel his firstborn son. What you can gather from that is the old covenant is very relational. Very relational. When we watch Israel's journey, it speaks of relationship. I told you that I believe that the two stone tablets are duplicates. There's two stone tablets. I ask you what's wrote on them. Five commandments on one, five on the other? I don't think so. Did he write the commandments that's about worshiping God on one and the ones about how to treat your neighbor on the other? I don't think so. I think the two stone tablets is duplicate copies. Because even now to back then, many contracts was done that way. I believe this is a marriage contract. Yet both tablets goes into the Ark of the Covenant, and Israel don't get her copy of the contract. Why? Because she will not keep it. So God retains it in his presence until Jesus walks it out to walks out Israel's side of the contract. This is what we've been teaching. Go back and listen to all this. It's really good, really good. So Matthew, on one hand, Jesus is walking out Israel. Let me tell you what else he does. He's also walking out Adam. So if he walks out Israel, I think that's about relationship. I really do think now it's making its way for redemption in Jesus Christ. We know that the law is the pattern, or it is the shadow that points to the reality. It's about Jesus. It points to Jesus. But when you find, if you read the story of Israel in the Old Covenant like it was a storybook and you didn't know nothing about it, you would really pick up on the relational dynamics. Relationship dynamics between Israel and Yahweh. But you find also in the book of Matthew, Jesus is not just walking out Israel's journey, which is clear as day. Y'all see that, right? The parallels, except Jesus goes to Transfiguration, they go to Sinai. He's also walking out Adam and Eve. Because I showed you a few weeks ago, you have to listen to this, where when he goes into the wilderness, Jesus is the second Adam. And I begin to show you that what happens is God created Eden for Adam and Eve. He created the world for Adam and Eve. And he makes Adam and Eve in his likeness, in his image. He puts them in the earth that he created for them. He says, multiply, fill the earth. Fill the earth with what? With my image and with my likeness, because that's the way you're made. And I want you to have dominion over the earth. Have dominion. I made it for you, Adam. But what happens is Satan sneaks in. He makes his way to Eden. Eden was not made for Satan. Eden is this lush garden, right? It's fruit, it's prosperity. Look, the thing is, Adam has not failed yet. He walks with God in the cool of the day. God has given him everything in Eden. In other words, I say it like this because I don't have many good illustrations and I'm competitive and I like to play sports. Satan goes into Adam and Eve's home turf, home field advantage. So when Satan or the serpent tempts Adam and Eve with the three temptations, lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, pride of life, we walk through that. He does it in a place where Adam should have never failed. Not there. I mean, he comes into the perfect habitat for humanity, and that is where God is set up for prosperity. He has all the dominion, but when Adam succumbs to the sin, then he loses dominion as well. Satan takes over dominion. He takes over dominion. This is why when Jesus is tempted out here in the wilderness, he takes him to a high mountain and says, if you worship me, I'll give you all the kingdoms. Bow down and worship me, I'll give you all the kingdoms. How's he going to give Jesus all the kingdoms? Because Adam forfeited it. Okay, right? And so this time, though, Jesus comes, puts on flesh, dwells among us, and instead of Satan going to Adam's home field advantage, Jesus comes here because Adam's lost dominion, and he goes out into a wilderness. Jesus is picking a fight with the devil. It says the Holy Spirit took Jesus into the wilderness to be tempted. This was God's sovereign plan. He was sent on a mission. Go wrap yourself. Go step into the dressing room of your mother Mary's womb. Wrap yourself in the flesh. And at the appointed time, I want you to go out there. And I want you to go find the devil. Holy Spirit's going to take you right to him. And you make right what Adam made wrong. He's tempted the same way. Both over identity. Adam. God don't want you to eat that because you'll be like him. I told you, Adam's response should have been, well, he already told me I'm made in his likeness and in his image, so I don't need to eat that. That's what he should have said, but that ain't what he said. Serpent, Satan, tempts Adam, says, look, God's lying to you. He's just telling you this because he don't want you to be like him. Well, he challenges Adam's identity in God. He challenges God's faithfulness in his word. So when Jesus goes to the wilderness to pick this fight with the devil, this is important on where we're going, okay? When he goes there, what he does is he goes through the same temptations. If you are the Son of God, Satan's attacking his identity just like Adam. Jesus responds every time, well, it is written. He responds, well, this is what my Father says. But he uses the same Bible you got, same scriptures that you can use. That's good. That's good. And so he says, no, I do trust my God. I do trust the Father. So he makes right what Adam, clearly, he is the second Adam. So in Matthew, we see him reenact the temptation in Eden, except it's a different location. Jesus goes into the place where he would be most likely to fail, in a desert place, hungry, 40 days, right? So tired, the angels had to bring him out, but he does come back in the power of the Spirit. So you see that in Matthew, Jesus not only walks out Israel's journey, their history, he goes back to the source, and he undoes what Adam did wrong, but he does one more thing. He is doing something spiritual. He's doing something spiritual against the spirit realm, okay? So that's about relationship between God and man. This is about man's relationship and his sin and his death and condemnation. But now he's doing something spiritual to all his opposition spiritually. That's something else going on in the book of Matthew. And that's where we've been. That's where we started last week. 2 weeks ago, I told you again, Jesus goes out into the wilderness to pick a fight with the devil. And last week, I began to show you that he goes to Transfiguration. He goes to Mount Hermon. And so this is where we are. I'm not going to finish all this today. There's no possible way. No possible way. But we got to get started here. Let's go back. I'm going to flip this thing around for you. And in Matthew, if you got your Bible, we'll look at some of that here in a moment. All right, let's read the Bible together. Matthew. If last week, Matthew 17, remember, after 6 days, Jesus takes Peter, James, and John up into a high mountain. He was transfigured before them. I'll stop there, but that's where Moses and Elijah is. This is Matthew 17, right? Jesus transfigures. The Greek word is metamorphuo, and it means to change from the inside out. To change from the inside out. So he's wrapped in the flesh. It's nearly like this Superman thing where, you know, he pulls back. This is what Jesus, he unveils the flesh to let them see who he really is. That's what's happening there. That's what's happening there. He unveils the flesh. They see his glory, his divinity. Moses is there. Elijah's there. Peter, James, and John ain't got a clue what to do with that. Right? That was last week. He does it on Mount Hermon. If you was here last week, you remember the significance. I'll remind you. He does that on Mount Hermon. But today, I want you to back up a chapter. Oh, goodness. Oh, Lord. Okay. Matthew 16. When Jesus came into the coast of Caesarea Philippi, that's important, Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, whom do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? They said, some say that thou art John the Baptist, some say Elijah, others say Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. He said unto them, but whom say ye that I am? Who do you say I am? Simon Peter answered and said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. That is so important. Son of the living God, Jesus answered and said, Blessed art thou, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto thee, but my Father which is in heaven. And I say unto thee that thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. I'll stop right there. Okay, listen. Before he goes up on Transfiguration, because Mount Hermon is here at Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea Philippi is at the base of Mount Hermon. So if Matthew 17 happens on Mount Hermon, then who do men say that I am? You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And then he says, and your name is Peter. Simon, your name is Peter. And upon this rock, I'll build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. That happens right here, Caesarea Philippi. Now, you remember I told you about Caesarea Philippi the other day, that what had happened was it's had different names throughout time. Right now, it is Benias or Golan Heights. I'll talk about that in a minute. But Caesarea Philippi, at Jesus' time, it's Caesarea Philippi. And if you'll remember that Caesar Augustus gives Herod the Great some land. Herod the Great gives his son Philip this territory when he dies. Philip changes the name. I think this is around 20 AD. Changes the name to Caesarea Philippi, Caesarea for Caesar, and Philippi obviously for his own name, Philip. So that is where they're at. What is modern-day Benias or the Golan Heights, it started off Canaan land and Bashan. It ended up being Panea. I don't know how far we can get through this, but this is where we are in the text right here, okay? Now, let me say this. Benias, Golan Heights, this is important because this is Canaan. There's always been war there, right? Children of Israel have to go into Canaan land and take it over. God give it to them, but he says, but you're going to go fight it and take it, right? I'll go before you. I'll give you victory. So they had to go fight for it. Well, you know, since that time, there's been war ever since, right? Ever since. So Benias, Banya, and let me say this, because it was previously named Pan. This is Hellenistic. This is Greek, Roman. Now they just changed the first letter because the Ugaritic don't have a P, so it's B. So this name is still coming from that name. But it's also called Golan Heights. Here's what I want you to know about that. This is where Mount Hermon is. I call it Hermon. The creek is Hermon. To this day, on one part of it, there's a ski lodge. On another part, there's military base for observation. Okay? In 1967, there was a six-day war. Israel fought over this area. Over Caesarea Philippi, over Golan Heights. They fought, they've been fighting over this thing, right? And during this time, Israel kind of gets some control over it, most of it anyway. 1973 and 74, they're attacked again. A lot of times they go at war with Syria over it. 73 and 74, they go into some war again. Then there's this somewhat peace treaty. By 81, it begins to be annexed to Israel. 2018 or 19, Donald Trump comes in and he declares that Israel has sovereignty over Mount Hermon, Bashan, Caesarea Philippi, the Golan Heights. Now, whether you like him or not, that is not the conversation today. That's what he did. This is also the place where, from Lebanon, missiles were shot this morning. Mount Hermon, Golan Heights. This morning. Three different locations they were attacked. This has to do with what's going on in the Gaza Strip. Right now. With Israel. Okay? By these Sunni Muslims. Okay, the thing is, Lebanon, this is the northern border of Israel. the Golan Heights is. It's the highest part. So you've got Syria over here. You've got Lebanon up here. You know, on this side of Syria, you got Iran. And so the problem is, Israel is Jews, right? Syria, and many of them are Muslims. Whether you want to or not, a lot of this war is going to have some, it's centered on religion to some degree, if not a large degree. It is, okay? It is. So this is happening right now. This is happening right now. So what we're saying, all this warfare, this history, it is stretching into today, right now, as we're up here. I didn't plan this. I didn't know that they would fire a missile over there today, by the way. They didn't call me and tell me or nothing when I was preparing this. This is just God's sovereignty, okay? Now let me say this. Oh, Lord, okay. Let's begin. God, help me here. Let's begin to fill this in. In Bashan, have I got Judges 3:3? Let me Judges 3. Namely, 5 lords of the Philistines and all the Canaanites and the Sidonites, the Hivites, dwelt in the mount at Lebanon from Mount Baal-Hermon. Baal-Hermon. You see that? Baal-Hermon. So, again, who was on transfiguration with Jesus? Elijah and Moses. Now, what does that mean? Well, Moses, when they are taking over the Canaan land, they are already worshiping the Canaanite god Baal. Not Moses and them, but the Canaanites. They worship Baal. Okay? And so he's taken over a people group. He's got to overcome these people in Canaan. They're worshiping a different god than Israel. Israel's worshiping Yahweh. They're worshiping Baal. Are y'all with me? This is why it's called Baal-Hermon. So I want to put down Baal right here. This is important because this is about God, this conquest. It ain't just about land, but this is about worship and who God is, okay? We find that. And so Elijah, by the time he comes along, Ahab's with Jezebel. Who's Israel worshiping at that time? It was Israel against the Canaanites that worshiped Baal. And by the time Israel does a horrible garbage job at their covenant with God, their relationship with God, by the time you get to Elijah, now Jezebel has got a hold of Ahab, the king of Israel, and now they are eliminating Yahweh worship, even in the land of Israel, and now they're worshiping Baal. So God sends Elijah, and on Mount Carmel, he has the showdown with Baal. And this is where Yahweh humiliates Baal. But Elijah leaves and ends up, goes to a tree, then to a cave. He is pouting, he's depressed, and he says, I'm the only one left. The covenant is over. The old covenant, the law, the covenant between God and Israel, it is over. Israel, my people, failed you so bad, it's over. I'm the only one left. God comes by, and by the way, Elijah's on Mount Sinai where Moses was when he got the covenant. God shows up with storms and all kind of stuff, but he don't speak through that. He speaks through a still small voice, right? And then God says to Elijah, he passes by Elijah, just like God putting Moses in the cleft of the rock and passing by. Moses has to veil his face. Elijah has to veil his face. Same stuff on the same mountain, centered on the same covenant. And Elijah's pouting, even though Baal just got humiliated. And God says, and quit crying because you ain't the only one left. I got a bunch more prophets. Now, Philippi, Caesarea Philippi, Bashan. This is Baal's mountain. That's Baal's mountain, Mount Hermon. So the significance of Jesus going up to the transfiguration and unveiling his deity is to do what he did in the wilderness. He's picking a fight with the spirit realm. He's picking a fight with his enemy and saying, oh, you say this is your mountain, Baal-Hermon. Well, why don't you come do something about it? Come prove it, big boy. Jesus goes, look, it may not mean something to some 2023 westernized person picking up a Bible, but if you grew up during this time, you know that Jesus, he didn't go on Mount Sinai and transfigure. He didn't go on Zion and transfigure. He goes to Mount Hermon. This is where Baal gets worshipped. This is Baal's mountain, and that's where he transfigures. That was last week. This is this week, though, so we got to go a little further. Got to go a little further. Okay. You got Deuteronomy 3? I give you Genesis 3, I think. It's Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 3:1. Y'all got to pay attention right here. Look, I want to tell visitors, it usually ain't like this. But the preaching like this, we got to slow down here. Doing a lot more drawing and teaching, so we got to go slow here. Then we turned and went up the way to Bashan. Everybody say Bashan. And Og, the king, this is so good, of Bashan came out against us, he and his people, to battle at Edrei. Next verse. And the Lord said unto me, fear him not, for I will deliver him and all his people and his land into thy hand, and thou shalt do unto him as thou didst unto Sihon, king of the Amorites, which dwelt at Heshbon. So the Lord our God delivered into our hands Og also, the king of Bashan, and all his people, and we smote him until none was left to him remaining. Now, Jared, go on down for me, please, sir, to verse number 8. We'll look at verse 8 through 11. And we took at that time out of the hand of the two kings of the Amorites the land that was on this side of Jordan from the river of Arnon unto Mount Hermon. Bashan is at the bottom of Hermon, which Hermon, the Sidonites call it Sirion, and the Amorites call it Shinar. All the cities of the plain and all of Gilead and all Bashan and Salchon, Edra, cities of the kingdom of Og in Bashan. For only Og, king of Bashan, remained of the remnant of giants. We're getting somewhere. Only Og, king of Bashan, remained of the remnant of giants. Behold, his bedstead was a bedstead of iron. It is not in Reboth of the children of Ammon? Question mark. 9 cubits was the length thereof, and 4 cubits the breadth of it after the cubit of a man. So if you don't get nothing else, there's a king named Og who rules Bashan and the territories around Bashan at the foot of Mount Hermon. He's a giant. Are we on the same page? He's a giant. He's a giant. Now, this is where we're about to part, some of us. So if you believe the sons of God that came into the daughters of men produced Nephilim and that they are literal giants, I hold that view. Some people believe that they're metaphorical giants. In other words, giants, just men of that are selfish, self-centered, men of power and authority. And so, but I believe it's literal myself. Either way, we're going to come to the same point. So remember, Bashan, it's where Caesarea Philippi is, at the foot of Mount Hermon. It was ruled by a king named Og. All right. Give me Deuteronomy 4, 47 and 48, please. I'm just going to walk you through some of this. And they possessed his land and the land of Og, king of Bashan. By the way, Og's mentioned 22 times in the Bible. A lot to say about him. That probably means something. Two kings of the Amorites, which were on the side of Jordan toward the sun rising from Aroer, which is by the bank of the river Arnon, even unto Mount Sinai, which is Hermon. This is Og's place, man, right there at the foot of Mount Hermon. Give me verse. Oh, is that verse 48 too? Okay, let's press on. I'll break some stuff down in a minute. Give me Numbers 21:33. Numbers 21:33. And they turned and went up by the way of Bashan, and Og, the king of Bashan, went out against them, he and all his people, to battle at Edrei. And the Lord said unto Moses, fear him not, for I have delivered, don't be afraid of him, for I have delivered him into thy hand, and all his people, and his land, and thou shalt do to him as thou didst unto Sihon, king of the Amorites, which dwelt at Heshbon. So they smote him and his sons and all his people until there was none left, none left him alive, and they possessed his land. Just keep tracking. We're going some. Let's do Deuteronomy 2. Deuteronomy 2. The Emims dwelt therein in times past, a people great and many and tall as the Anakims, which also were accounted giants, and the Anakims, but the Moabites called them Emims. The Horams also dwelt in Seir before time, but the children of Esau succeeded them when they had destroyed them from before them and dwelt in their stead. And Israel did unto the land of his possession, which the Lord gave unto them. Let's look at Joshua 12:4. Y'all just bear with me. It's just the Bible. So, at the coast of Og, king of Bashan, which was of the remnant of the giants that dwelt in Ashtaroth, and Edrei reigned in Mount Hermon, and Salcah, and in all Bashan, under the border of the Geshurites, the Maacathites, half Gilead, the border of Sihon, king of Heshbon. Over and over and over, the king of Bashan, Og, and all his giant people, okay? The giants. Now, where did I get to? Give me Amos 2. Amos 2. Yet destroyed I the Amorite before them, whose height was like the height of cedars. He was strong as the oaks, yet I destroyed his fruit from above and his roots from beneath. I also brought you up from the land of Egypt and led you 40 years through the wilderness to possess the land of the Amorite. I think we'll stop right there. Now, at least we understand that there are Og's. By the way, this is the plain right here by Mount Hermon. So Og, during this time at Bashan, Og the king, he was a giant and had many giants. They had the land. Israel had to go in. Some of the same stuff when they send out spies, 10 of them, they're scared to death, right? And they just waste time, a lot of time out there, but they eventually go in. They take over the land. I'm about to make a point here. So you got to remember, oh Lord, let me go back here. Let me show you a couple of more, and then I'm going to fill that thing out. Go back to Deuteronomy 3:11. This is important. This is important. For Og, king of Bashan, remained of the remnant of the giants. Behold, his bedstead was a bedstead of iron. Is it not Reboth to the children of Ammon? So this is what's interesting. The Hebrew word here, is it not Reboth? Anybody else got a different translation? Somebody give me some other King James. I'm curious to see what it says. It's going to read different, I'm pretty sure. Okay, only Og, king of Bashan, was left of the remnant of the Rephites. Does anybody else have a different translation? Hers was the NIV, mine was King James. Anybody else got a different translation? Rephaim? Rephaim. That's it, the word Rephaim, Reboth. Okay, so it says that the giants, he's a descendant. Og, the king of Bashan, was a descendant of the Rephaim. Rephaim, this is important. Oh, my goodness. That is the original word in the Hebrew, Rephaim. Rephaim. Okay, Deuteronomy 20:20. I give you the wrong reference. Listen to this. 2:20. Deuteronomy 2:20. If that's it. That is it. That also was accounted a land of giants. Giants dwelt therein. That phrase, land of giants, is one Hebrew word. That's Rephaim. Rephaim. So Rephaim is the giants. That is the bloodline. That is the giants. And Og come from the Rephaim. Okay? This is going to make more sense in a minute. Let me start by reminding you of this right here. Let's remember that what happens here. We read Enoch last week, that Baal is worshipped here, but Genesis 6:4 says the sons of God came into the daughters of men and produced the Nephilim, this race of giants. Now, Enoch clearly says the same thing, except Enoch says it happened on Mount Hermon. That on Mount Hermon, the fallen angels assembled with the daughters of men, took them as wives, produced a race of giants. That's what Enoch says. Genesis 6:4 says, sons of God came into the daughters of men. We talked about this last week. And the outcome were giants. this race of giants, this hybrid giant. Now, let's think about this. I just read you 100 Bashan scriptures about an area of giants and this one giant named Og, the king. Okay, that's happening here. Genesis 6 and other references says that the fallen angels came here with the daughters of men and produced a race of giants, and this is where Baal is worshipped. But right here, the land is inhabited by giants. That sounds pretty consistent, right? Are you with me? That is pretty consistent. So I wrote down at Bashan, fallen angels. You got Baal, this god, this idea of a god named Baal, fallen angels, and Nephilim. This is why I say that this is spiritual. Like, Jesus walks out Israel's journey in his life to redeem Israel and to do right what Israel did wrong. But he also goes back and relives Adam's failure in the wilderness, and just it perfectly parallels Adam's temptation in Eden. So Jesus comes to redeem humanity, to lift the curse, to lift death, to restore humanity from its fallen state. And then this public display of a relationship between humanity and man through Israel and the old covenant that just constantly went south, Jesus is living that out for Israel, his people, and making that right through a man named Jesus. But he's also, at the same time, he's doing all that. He is coming and he's picking a fight with spirit beings. He's declaring something to them. He's making something known. He is instigating when he comes right here. He is declaring to every spirit being that I am God. I am God. I am God. I am God. And what has been worshipped here is nothing. I am God. And what you did here, I'm coming to undo. And he's dealing with these Nephilim as well. Now, here's what I want you to know about the Nephilim, these giants. Now, you agree or not agree, the point is this. Say, Brother Stetton, I don't believe in that. Fallen angels coming in, daughters of women, and all that stuff. That's fine. That's fine. But the people at the time believed it that Jesus is talking to until about 400 A.D. During this time, this is what they believed. So it don't matter what you see in Winston County. It matters what they see when this is how they believed on the same mountain that ever since they are little boys and little girls, they're taught that fallen angels does this here and that Nephilim lived here. When they are taught that as Jewish boys and little Jewish girls, and now they stand right here where they hear this, whether they believe it or not, they still understand what Jesus does when he transfigures before them. My God, here. This is strategic. Jesus goes there to show his divinity and his deity. Let me read you a little bit from Enoch, and I don't believe that it's canon. I'm probably closer than I've ever been, but I don't believe it's canon. I believe some of it's certainly infallible and inspired. That's why it's quoted in Jude. But let me just read you. Here's Enoch, a man that walked with God. This is what he writes. God spoke to me. He says, "Do not be afraid, Enoch. You are a scribe of righteousness." In other words, write down my righteous words. Don't be afraid. "Come here, hear my voice." It actually says, "Approach hither and hear my voice." But he says, "Go say to the fallen angels." Go say to them. He says, basically, I'm interceding for you, but yet you've set yourself up as gods that's supposed to be interceding for men. That's what he says. "Wherefore have you forsaken the lofty and holy heaven, which endures forever, and have lain with women, and defiled yourselves with the daughters of men, have taken yourselves wives, have acted like the sons of the earth, and have begotten an impious offspring? You, being spiritual, holy, possessing a life which is eternal, have polluted yourselves with women, have begotten into carnal blood, has lusted after the blood of men, and have done as those who are in flesh and blood do." These however, die and perish. Therefore have I given to them wives, that they might cohabit with them, that sons might be born of them, and that this might be transacted upon the earth. But you from the beginning were made spiritual, possessing a life which is eternal and not subject to death forever. Therefore I made not wives for you, because being spiritual your dwelling is in heaven. But they left heaven. Now the giants who have been born of spirit and flesh shall be called upon earth as evil spirits, and on earth shall be their habitation. Evil spirits shall proceed from their flesh, because they were created from above, from the holy watchers of the fallen angels was their beginning and primary foundation. Evil spirits shall they be upon the earth. The spirits of the wicked shall they be called. Habitation of the spirits of heaven shall be in heaven, but upon the earth shall be the habitation of terrestrial spirits who are born of the earth. The spirits of giants shall be like clouds which shall oppress, corrupt, fall, content, and bruise upon the earth. Let me tell you what that says. Whether you believe it or not, this is what it says, and this is what they were taught. I'll let you pick wherever you want to land on it. That God is passing judgment on the fallen angels. He says, you have conceived in my women that I created, and a race has come forth, and it is a tainted race. He says, so this is what will happen, because their mama is a human, and because their daddy's a fallen angel, then one day their body will die, and they don't have a soul like a human soul, so they will be evil spirits that roam the earth, and I'll judge them later. So Enoch teaches that there are fallen angels, and when they come into daughters of men, they birth a race of giants. And when giants die, their soul, or whatever it's called, is what demons are today. That's the origin, according to this theory. Now, have you ever thought about the origin of demons? You ever have any? I mean, there's only a few theories out there that there's some being that preceded Adam, or that they are the same thing as a fallen angel, or that they are the soul of the Nephilim, the giants that come from the fallen angels. Now, I hold to the third. I don't care what you hold to. I hold to the third. I hold to the third, and I'll tell you why in a minute. Let me just remind you of this. Let me remind you of this. Just hang with me here. Hang with me here. Number one, Matthew 25, Jesus will later say that hell was prepared for the angels and the demons, distinguishing between the two. He ain't talking about the good angels in heaven. That ain't who he's sending there. Peter says there's already angels that's locked up. So he distinguishes between angels and demons. Jesus does. He makes distinguishes. So now, here's the idea of Matthew. This is what Jesus teaches on demons. The unclean spirit is gone out of a man. Matthew 12:43. He walketh through dry places. He seeks rest. He findeth none. Then he will return. Said, I will return into the house from whence I came out. And when he has come, he findeth an empty, swept, and garnished. And then we find that this demon, this legion of demons, Jesus casts them out. And they don't want to go out. They said, well, can we go into the pigs? And it is the idea that they enter into the world with a body that's a giant body. But when the giant body dies, their habitation is a body, so they want to indwell a man. So fallen angels are principalities and rulers and spiritual wickedness in high places, and the demonic are the evil spirits that have, of the giants that have died, that roam the earth, that want to inhabit a human being. Demon possession. That ain't the fallen angel that possesses a man. He can appear as a man. Hebrews says he can walk around us unaware. But the demonic inhabits, we've read, all through demon possession. So, but again, if you don't believe all that, that's fine. They did. And I'm going somewhere with this. So, let's see here. We have the Nephilim. Let me go back up. Let me bring to you something a little different. No. Let me do this. Let's look at Matthew 17. Now, let's not forget this, that they go here, who do men say that I am? You're the Son of the living God. Gates of hell won't prevail against it. He goes up here, Baal's mountain where the Nephilim come down. He shows himself as deity. What happens when they come back down in Matthew 17? Anybody want to tell me? What does Jesus come down the mountain for? Right after all this, coming back down to the same area, what does Jesus come into? 9 disciples that's dealing with a demon-possessed person. The 9 disciples have been with the other 3 casting out demons like crazy. It ain't been a problem. But Jesus comes down the mountain into this area, and somebody comes running, Jesus, we got a problem because we got a demon-possessed one, and your disciples can't do nothing about it. Now, they've been casting out devils. But now they've come across one they can't cast out. Jesus says, well, this kind only comes out by prayer and fasting. I find it ironic that this kind of demon is hanging around where all the Nephilim lived, where Baal is worshipped, where fallen angels come down, that this kind of demon that's different than the others, a little stronger, they're having a problem with it. They're having a problem. So Bashan represents Baal. It represents this place of the fallen angels. It represents the Nephilim. It represents demons or evil spirits. And this is where Jesus transfigures. Territory is everything. This is the area in his strategy he goes to do one of the most unbelievable displays on earth, unveil his glory right here. Does it make sense to anybody? Whether you believe in all that or not, this is what the text says. This is what they believed. Now, I got to get further. We won't finish this today, but I got to read you this. I'm about to read you something, Jacob, that blew my mind, okay? I just showed you Deuteronomy 3:11, Deuteronomy 2:20, where in the King James, the word land of giants is the Hebrew word rephaim. Okay, we looked at Deuteronomy 3:11. Og, king of Bashan, behold, his bedstead was a bedstead of iron. Is it not the rephaim of the children of Ammon? Right? Now, rephaim is literally translated giants, as it's talking about Og. But now I want you to look at Isaiah 26:14. This is going to blow your mind. This is going to blow your mind. It may not. They are dead. They shall not live. They are deceased. They shall not rise. Therefore hast thou visited and destroyed them and made all their memory to perish. Does anybody want to know what the Hebrew word for deceased is right there in verse 14? I challenge you, check me all this. The correct guess for the word deceased is rephaim. Look, I hadn't been rambling and confusing this whole time for nothing. I'm just slow. This thing's going to come together in a minute. The same Hebrew word for giants is now the word for the dead. I don't know about that. Okay. Proverbs 9:18. I've never heard this. I've never seen this. I've never heard. But he knoweth not that the dead are there and that her guests are in the depths of hell. Does anybody want to know what the Hebrew word for dead is right there? There's different Hebrew words, but the one right there, the dead that are in the depths of hell. Well, okay, what about Job 26:5? Job 26:5. Dead things are formed from under the waters and the inhabitants thereof. Don't forget waters. I'm going to teach you something, and you're going to be like, I don't know about all that. And then if you will, you'll go home and check me out, and you're going to come back real excited and be like, I wish I'd just... Dead things... Rephaim. So now the Hebrew word rephaim, when you're reading in a translation, not the original text. The original text just says rephaim. That's all it says. And here it just says rephaim, but it's been translated and it made its way to one of in this text. Rephaim means giants, but over here the Hebrew word rephaim means the dead. Over here, rephaim means giants. Over here means dead. And so, again, fallen angels come into the daughters of men. They produce a race of giants, but they're not full-blooded humans. They're these half-breeds. So they have a body, and it's the giant. But when the giant's killed, when they take over Canaan, the spirit of the giant cannot leave because God announced that it would roam the earth, the spirit, until judgment. And this is the land of the giants. And this is where this really powerful demon is, who would have been the inner being of the giant. That could have been Og still holding on to his territory as an evil spirit. Could have been. I ain't saying it is. I don't know. But I do know this. Oh, Lordy. Okay. Isaiah 38:10. I said, in the cutting off of my days, I shall go to the gates of the grave. I am deprived of the residue of my years. This is what blows my mind. Oh, by the way, in the 5th century, there's an inscription on a tomb to this day that's dated to 5th century B.C. And it says this right here, Og, the Phoenician deity, is the protector of death. And it's there right now. This is what they believed. That even Og, after he died, he is deity, he is God, and he protects death, hell, and the grave. That's what they believed. That's 5th BC. This is what they're walking into. If that is 5th BC, 2 years later, that's the stuff that's inscribed on the wall around here, that he's the keeper of hell, he's the keeper of the tombs, he's the keeper, he is the God that's the keeper of the tombs. But Jesus walks right here where there's 14 temples in Caesarea Philippi and statues everywhere, and he walks right there in the middle of all that. He says, hey, who do men say that I am? I want to know what they're saying about me. That, well, you're in the wrong place to talk about this, but back home they say that you're Jeremiah, and no, back home over there and where the Jews are, they say that you are Elijah. He said, no. I want to know, well, who do you say that I am right here? And Peter says, I believe that you are the Christos, the Christ, the Son of the living God. This too, because what he says is, yes, that is correct. No man could teach you this, because men teach otherwise. But my Father in heaven has taught you this. And listen to this right here. On this rock, I said, Brandy, which rock? She said, well, probably this rock. It's a twofold statement. Remember, I told you the nature of Jesus is he ain't like us. We say a whole lot of stuff, but we ain't saying nothing. Right? Jesus says very little, but he says a whole lot. I've given you hundreds of examples. This is one of the examples. So the play on words here is when he asked Peter, he says, yes, my Father showed you that, Simon, and now your name's Peter. And upon this rock I'll build my church. Now, the word for Peter in the Greek means small rock. When Jesus says on this rock is a different Greek word, it is giant rock. Now, this is what I know about a rock, and I'm not no rockologist. What? I don't know. That's what happened with. Look here. He's saying something to Peter. I've always said, Peter, Simon, I'm changing your name to Little Rock. Catholic makes Peter the rock. There's a lot of people. One thing Jesus is saying is you're a little rock. My Father give you revelation. You are a little rock. I'm big rock. I am your foundation. I'm bigger than you, but you're made in the likeness and the image of me. You're still little rock. I'm sure little rock, but in my rockology, I learned that a little rock still made of the same thing a big rock's made of. It's just one's bigger and one's smaller. I can't go real far. I'm just real simple, okay? Peter, I'm the big rock. You're the little rock, but you are the little version of me. but I am the foundation for you, and this is how my church is built. That is clearly one meaning of that statement, but there is another meaning of a message. That message is sent to Peter, but the spirit audience nearby, because he's in one of the most evil places on earth, because the Rephaim, Og is the king of the Rephaim, which means the giants, but it also means he's the king of death. This is why on the tombs, Og, the deity, who is the guardian of the graves in hell. This is what they believe here. And there is, check it out, please. There is something down here that you can Google to this day called the gates of hell. The gates of hell. I dare you. The gates of hell. Look, spiritually, when he says, Peter, you're little rock, I'm big rock, I build my church on this, and the gates of hell, he's talking about real death and hell. But when he comes here, he's speaking a message to the spiritual enemy as well. He says this right here. He says, Peter, tell him who I am. I love this. I love this. This is spiritual warfare. Peter don't even know he's participating in spiritual warfare. He just had to have the right answer. He said, Peter, hey, you don't know where we are. You don't know what I got up my sleeve, but I'm here today picking a fight. Would you tell them who I am? Would you say it out loud? Who am I? You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And he said, yep, and you can add to this right here. Upon this rock, I'll build my church, the rock that sits over the gates of hell. I'll put my church right here, and the gates of hell can't stop it. That's what the demonic heard. Jesus said, I got your mountain. I got my mountain in Zion. I got Moriah. This one's been yours. I'll take it too. Remember last week, Psalm 68? Everything to do with this. So look, the word Rephaim, it speaks of death and hell. Og, the king, the ruler of Rephaim, ruler of death and hell, but he's also of Rephaim, of death and hell, but he's also Og, the king of the giants, but he's also Og, the king of death and hell, but that's where he comes from, Rephaim. That's the name, Rephaim. Okay. This is what's going on in Bashan during this time. We'll probably next week get to what's going on in Pania. The whole other storyline, but it's all consistent from here to here to here. We'll get there. So understand, after he makes his statement that the gates of hell can't prevail against this right here, and he just shows his deity, what's the first thing he does? He goes down and proves it all by dealing with a demon that can't nobody else deal with. Do you think that's coincidence? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. You know what they would do? You can read this. This ain't in the Bible. I love it when I can read the Bible, then I find literature that ain't even that supports what the Bible's teaching. The gates of hell right here is a cave with water in it. There's old literature that says it's never been plumbed. They've never found a rope long enough they could tie weight to that could touch the bottom. And when the Canaanites' kings died, a lot of times they would throw them in this cave that has water because they believed this was the portal way from hell and into the earth. I don't know if it is or not. You don't know. You might believe it. You might not. It don't matter. This is what they're believing. They're about to believe a lot wilder stuff than this. But this is what they're believing. They'd go to this place, the gates of hell, on Mount Hermon, and they would throw the bodies in there, and that their kings would rise and come back and help them in battle. This is pagans against God's people. That their king would go in there when he died, and he would rise to attain victory. Jesus is messing with them. Would you tell them who I am? You're the Christos. You're the anointed one. That's the language for the king. That's right. I'm the king. And what they don't know, and we'll make our way there. It's what this symbolizes to all them. Jesus will literally do. He will enter in to hell, and he'll come back alive with victory. This is what they believe here about Og and later on Pan. Every generation comes up with a new one. Same story. Jesus makes his way over here, and he attacks what they believed in Bashan, what they believed in Panea. Different characters, same storyline. We'll get there next week. Jesus goes right here. He asks the question, who do they say I am? Tell them who I am. That's right. I'm the Son of the living God. I am the King. He climbs up the mountain. He reveals his deity, comes down, deals with the demon. Something's happening here. Now, I'm just introduced you to what is happening here. You may not be okay with it. That's okay. Read a little bit about it. Let me get to here and here and bring in New Testament scripture and get back to Psalm 68 and Ephesians 4 before you count me out. It's going to get real good. I had to just lay some teachy groundwork. But if this is Bashan, he is exposing Baal just like he did the Egyptian gods, just like he did at Nineveh, just like he did Baal. He is sending a message to angels that Peter says is locked up, that the Nephilim, the giants, were here, and what is said about them, whether that's so or not, this is what the people believe. He is tearing down every false notion of what God is in their mind and every false presentation of God that would steal the glory of himself. He tears it all down, humiliates it all to show them, I am God. I told you last week, I told you this week. Do you know the greatest thing you need in your life is a revelation of the true person of Jesus Christ, who he really is. If your soul could behold the grandeur and the reality of Jesus Christ, it would change how you walk in this place. It would change how you pray. It would change how you talk to your wife. It would change how you carry yourself in public. It would change how you do what you plan. It would change how you spend. If it really ever sit in, that Jesus really is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, and he overcome death, hell, and the grave, and he is trying to reveal it to you. If it ever set in on a man's heart who he really is, he is not Sunday school Jesus. He is not Bible school Jesus. He is the Son of the living God. And know this, that when he makes the statement here, no demon or fallen angel come to him and challenged him. So he gets a little bit more intense. He says, what about this? And he shows again who he is. And yet there is no demon or fallen angel that meets him there to challenge him. He sends a bold message to spiritual wickedness, who he is. Now, I want you to come back, because they will retaliate before Matthew's over. They will retaliate. I want you to see this. But the gates of hell, who do they say I am? You're the Christ, the Son of the living God. Remember, they believe their kings cast into the water and they rise again. Death is here. It represents death and hell at this mountain. It all geographically, it makes sense. Just you can Wikipedia gates of hell in Golan Heights. Dare you to do it. We'll get into Panea and Caesarea Philippi or Pan, because this is going to get deeper into spiritual wickedness of what he's addressing. But you have to leave here with the utmost confidence that Jesus, he is your Redeemer. He is your Savior. He walked out the failures of mankind. He carried the condemnation of sinful men. He got right what every man's got wrong. And he did that for you. But he also sent a bold message to every spiritual opposition. I told you last week, it says we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but principalities and powers. And right, well, who do you think Jesus was, his opposition? It wasn't flesh and blood either. And he has no worthy adversary, but it is warfare. So we're just going to pick back up, and now that I've laid the groundwork, if you will hang with me and let me get here and here, I promise you're going to get excited about some things. It is beautiful. But I believe in this season of beholding the glory of God. If we're going to see it, we've got to behold His glory in His love for humanity. We got to behold His glory in His redemptive plan for humanity. We got to behold His glory in how He has relationship with men through the old covenant. But we've got to behold His glory in how He is transcendent and victorious over the devil and every imp and foul spirit and dark angel and every. We've got to behold His glory in that. I need you to understand, you live in a real world. There's still spirits that are evil working today. They still fallen angels, I believe. There's still wickedness and darkness that is working. And if there's going to be victory, the church has to get something more than just the statement, in the name of Jesus, you're defeated. Because if you don't know the Jesus that you're throwing the name around, it means nothing to the devil that you're talking to. You can say His name, but look, if the devil don't know that you know His name, then it don't matter. Because some of y'all is going to deal with a foul spirit. I've said before, some of the best preaching I've ever did has been to a demon, I think. I don't know his name. I just know when I felt attacked by the enemy, some of the best gospel preaching is when I've stood up on a tree stump and preached to every foul spirit that would listen. And all I had is, Jesus died for me and He didn't die for you. He rose again to overcome death, and He is God over you. He set it for you a lake fire. He set for me in His. I just tell them how it is. Just preach the gospel. The gospel preach to a devil if the devil's messing with you. And it'll preach to a lost man. Lost man gets saved. It's the gospel. It's the power of God into salvation. Now, look, we're going to press on in. This will be a whole lot better if you go home and study it yourself. Then we can get on the same page, I think. Bashan, all the giants, who was the Nephilim, offspring of the fallen angels, the disembodied spirits are the demons. This place represents death and hell. Death and hell. Because Og, Bashan's here. He's the king of Og. He's from Rephaim, the dead. He's from the lineage of giants. And we're going to see something come to full picture right here when we come again, okay? I don't know. Say, what's this got to do with me today, Stetton? How's this supposed to help me? I don't know. You know what it does? It just makes me fall in love with Him more. I'm like, I see Him stand at this cave, at the gates of hell. I can see Him. They believe it's death and hell. That culture believes this is death and hell. Terrorizing stories of the giants and the fallen angels. Terrifying stories. It's in the culture. Jesus, like, come on. We need to go out of our way to Caesarea Philippi. I got to deliver a message. I overcome the devil in the wilderness. But while I'm out healing sick folk, and while I'm out representing humanity, and while I'm out honoring my daddy, if you will go with me and let's stop by Caesarea Philippi, I got to send a message. They don't get it now. Okay, I'm with you. This is it, fellas. This is it. Here's this 14 temples of false gods where they all sacrifice into the gates of hell. Alexander the Great sacrificed into the gates of hell, this cave. Alexander the Great, well documented. Y'all don't need, just wait till next week. I got to send a message. Who do they say I am? This and this and this. No. Who am I? You're the Christ, Son, the living God. Say it louder so they can hear it in the back. I believe you're Christ, the Son of the living God. I believe you are the King. As He's standing at the gates of hell where they would throw mighty kings in to this cave that they might come forth and usher victory. Who am I again? You're the Christos. You're the mighty King. Who am I? You are the Messiah. You are the King of Kings. Who else am I? You are the Son of the Living God. That's right. Og, you're dead. I'm the Son of the Living God, Living God, Living God. He says, y'all don't even know it now. Peter, you don't. I'm telling you now, there's no way you can get it. This might be one of the first times Peter's ever heard the word church. They weren't a church yet. I'm telling you something, Peter, that it ain't for you today because you ain't going to understand it. But on this rock, I'll build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And so he ain't just telling Peter. He's letting them know, I'm coming, I'm coming, I'm coming, I'm coming. I'm coming, I'm coming. I'm coming. Gates, you can lock them up, but I'm going to bust right through. You just hang with me where he's going. Gates don't attack nothing. Gates are attacked. Gates keep stuff out. Gates keep stuff out. He says, but your gates can't keep me out. And it can't keep me in either. Did you hear that? That's all a gate does. A gate keeps something out or something in. And he says the gates don't prevail against what I got going on. They can't keep me out and they can't keep me in. And Peter, you don't understand now. But they can't keep you out and they can't keep you in if you were me. He leads captivity captive. Oh, my God, we're going somewhere. We're going somewhere. He's picking a fight. He says, well, where are we going now? Climb this mountain. Come with me. It's a long way. I'm tired. Climb this mountain. Gets to the top. Backs up the statement on the bottom through the transfiguration on the top. And he brings two witnesses because with Jews, you need two witnesses. Right? Moses, hey. I fought against all them people and their God Baal, and Yahweh was better every time. Elijah says the same thing. I had to go against them too in their God Baal, and Yahweh was better. He's got two witnesses. Whew. I'm the one that was with Moses. I'm the one that was with Elijah. I am God in the flesh. He needs his disciples to believe this. Me, not you, me. He needed the three to see that nine couldn't deal with this one demon when normally they can, but Jesus could. He needed them. It ain't you. It's me. It's me. It's me. This is who you got on your side. He's picking a fight. He's instigating something with the enemy. He's taking back territories. He makes the claim. In their territory, he makes the claim. And he ain't done. My God, he ain't done. He ain't done. Remember, we looked at Psalm 68. It says, the hills of Bashan. This was last week. The hills of Bashan. Look over at the hills of the Lord. And the hills of Bashan, those on them, they hide as they look on with envy for the one that stands on the hill of the Lord. The hills of Bashan. This is some, he says, these fallen angels, these demonic, they hide when I show up. They want to be me, but they can't be me. I'm the only God, yet they're terrified of me. Baal with nothing but a counterfeit Yahweh. That's all he ever was, a counterfeit Yahweh. They look on me with envy. They look on me with envy. Og, this king, this demon child of a fallen angel. He's the guardian of death and hell. He's the keeper, the mighty warrior, the king. He's nothing but a counterfeit Jesus. That's all he ever was a counterfeit Jesus. They look on, they want to be me, but they can't be me. I'm God. I'm the Son of God. You're fighting a spiritual battle, church. Okay? It ain't about how much you can pray in tongues. It ain't about how much you tithe. It's about how much you know this Jesus. I'm afraid he's bigger than some of us thinks he is. I'm afraid your enemy's bigger than what you're giving him credit for. We're walking around worried over petty, stupid stuff during the week. I'm afraid the enemy's way bigger than what we think he is. But God is way bigger than what our enemy is. And he's way bigger than what we think he is. And God is revealing to you his majesty and his splendor. He rubs it in and says, he wouldn't do that. You said it. Colossians, we'll get there. Colossians says he made a show of it openly. It says he took the principalities, the rulers, and Jesus in his walk on earth. He openly triumphed and made a show showing the folly and the weakness. That's the word. That ain't me. I'm not trying to paint you what men call a masculine Jesus. I'm telling you who the Bible says he is. He mocks his enemy as he parades them around. That's your God. That's your God. That's the glory you're supposed to behold. That if you can behold that, something in you is going to transform you, and it's going to be more like that. He tears down every opposing spirit.